Welcome to another episode of Adoption, The Making of Me, an oral history of adoptee stories. I'm Sarah Reinhart.
And I'm Louise Brown. Make sure to find us on the socials at The Making of Me Podcast. Our website is adoptionthemakingofme.com.
Thank you.
Thanks.
On today's episode, we will be continuing to discuss Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood by Gretchen Sisson. And we will be bringing on adoptee Jessica. Stay tuned.
Hi, Louise.
Hi, Sarah.
I know you've got a rough voice right now, but we're just jumping in here to talk about our Patreon Zoom group coming up on May 11th.
Yeah. And today's guest is a Patreon.
Yeah. Our today's guest is a Patreon. She's a part of our Zoom group. It's growing and it's great. We love having new people and new ideas. So if you want to join our monthly Patreon Zoom, go to patreon.com and join at the $10 level. And we'll see you once a month.
Yeah. We'll see you. The next time we're going to be talking about relinquishment or a reunion, I think.
Reunion. Yes. Talking about like the good, the bad, the indifferent.
Yep.
Whatever your reunion experience is or isn't.
Yep.
That's what we're talking about. So yeah, we're doing topics now, which is fun.
Yeah, it's fun. Okay, well, see you there.
See you there. Hi, we want to take a moment on behalf of the youngest, most vulnerable members of our adoption community to invite and encourage our listeners to learn about the ongoing issue that children are being adopted, abused, and sometimes leading to death. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and we are supporting a growing movement to raise awareness of this tragic issue. Please contact our former guest, Moses Farrow, moses@mosesfarrow.com, to learn more and join the effort. Thank you. Hi, Louise.
Hi, Sarah.
Well, here we are back with Relinquished by Gretchen Sisson, the chapter Choosing Life, which was a long one, and I highlighted so much. We can't get into everything, but
I'm like, where to begin? So big.
So big.
What I thought was interesting is that she really narrows down in this whole chapter, just the overall thing of it is who's really, you know, choosing to keep a baby, who's really relinquishing. It's not at all what you would think, not even what I would sometimes think. You know what I mean? I was surprised by a lot of her data.
So she talked to somebody that was doing the Turnaway study, which was a 10-year project led by demographer Dr. Diana Green Foster. The study followed 956 women who sought abortions across the U.S., including over 160 women who gave birth after they were denied access to the abortions they wanted because they were over the gestational age limits of the clinics where they sought care. So Gretchen's saying in her work with Foster Gould and their colleague epidemiologist, Dr. Lauren Ralph, they found that only 15 of them, or 9%, including Emily and Sophia, who she writes about in this book, relinquished their infants for adoption. That means that a full 91% of women denied abortions went on to parent the children to whom they gave birth as a consequence of that denial.
Yeah.
So, you know, this trying to say that less abortions mean more adoptions is not true.
It's not true.
People genuinely don't really want to give their kids up, given the chance they will parent them.
That's what this part where she says, after the Dobbs decision came down, I spoke with many reporters who asked variations of the same question. Why aren't women who are denied abortion more interested in adoption? She gets into more. And she says, as a mother, though, I always wanted to ask them, under what circumstances would you give up your children?
You know, this is always
like
what it comes down to. I think I've talked about this before. You know, when I talk to people who, and I give them my views on adoption or the problematic stuff about adoption, and they're still in the mindset that there's nothing but good stuff, then that's the argument I use. Okay, well, think about you having to give up your child. And how do you think that child feels and you feel? And then it's kind of the, oh, I get it now. But it always takes that, you know. The knee-jerk response is always what the public narrative is.
Yeah, because they wanted choices. So to maybe they couldn't have more kids, you know, financially or whatever. But once they were past that, they'd rather keep their child than live with that missing thing forever, that hole.
Here it says, most women seeking abortion are fundamentally uninterested in adoption. In a survey of over 5,000 abortion patients, they were asked a series of true-false questions, including, I want to put the baby up for adoption instead of an abortion. Mm. In response, 99% of participants said that was false, and exactly 0% said it was true. Yeah. 1% said kind of.
Kind of, which was interesting. It's like they didn't know how to answer.
Right.
Well, you know, something that fascinated me about this whole thing is the people that were pregnant, that were seeking options for themselves, like right away, women would think, okay, I'm single. I don't have a lot of money. I'm going to look into care. Like, who can help with being a young mother? They're taken immediately on the internet, the amount of money spent on it to take them to adoption websites immediately.
Right.
And what messages they saw immediately. I didn't know that was really happening. That was actually eye-opening for me.
Yeah. Adoption agencies pay for traffics to their sites, as do prospective adoptive parents who create their own websites to showcase their family profiles. I mean, I don't know about you, but I see these all the time on Instagram.
Yeah.
You know, hopeful adoptive parents with their, we're, you know, Jim and Sue advertising themselves. It is kind of baffling to me that no one stops to think about what that is.
It's strange, the whole thing. I didn't even know this existed. In 2022, Choose Life Marketing, a digital marketing firm that works primarily with anti-abortion crisis pregnancy groups, they're doing geofencing, virtual geofencing. So everything filtered through any choice in your computer. And they don't put in abortion or adoption. They put in keywords like caring for my young baby or... Mm-hmm. You know, I know some of this from work, and it's like, I didn't realize, I don't know why I didn't realize it's that elaborate.
Another thing, you know, it does come down to money. The cumulative cost of these services and campaigns are in the thousands of dollars, when most relinquishing mothers report that they would be parenting if they had that much additional money in their own bank account.
Right.
And importantly, the costly bombardment of advertising is not always legal.
Mm-mm. I didn't know that either, that it's not legal, but who's going to stop it?
Right.
I mean, internet crime.
Well, because adoption is such a wonderful thing in the eyes of everybody, you know? Yeah. Both of these women that she's talking about in here, you know, adoption was kind of a last choice.
Both of them were 5 months pregnant when they figured out they were pregnant, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Too late stage. And, you know, no one helped them with anything. That's the thing that really, it's like, I was watching, this is so silly, but I've been ill and I was watching a Law and Order, and they had an episode that brought this up, and I was surprised because they actually had the right narrative on it, where she said, well, what do you mean that it was about an abortion clinic getting bombed or something? And then the lieutenant says, well, everybody wants to help, you know, be so helpful and so great. Who's going to take care of these kids or the mothers? No one cares about them afterwards. I thought, you know, this is the truth. It's just depressing to me.
I just highlighted little random things. Here's one. Taylor, a relinquishing mother, said, Taylor mentioned how one adoption agency with which she spoke offered to help with housing and transportation costs during pregnancy. She laughed at the memory. If I'd had an apartment and a car and all of that, I wouldn't be choosing adoption.
Yeah. And then as soon as they have a baby, they're persona non grata.
Oh, yeah. Don't
the minute.
They get ghosted. By the new adoptive parents, by the agency.
The agency that was their best friend.
This goes back, you know, all the way back to Margaret in American Baby, you know. Just so many stories like this. In these cases, just a minimal investment in families, more affordable housing, easier options for public health insurance, better paying jobs with parental and family leave, food security, affordable and reliable childcare would create an essential safety net that allows these mothers to raise the children they very much want to raise. I get too upset. It just...
Yeah. No, and you know, there's another thing I didn't realize either. Congress, there's a whole bunch of money going into family. What was it called? The National Council for Adoption. They get $8.6 million funding went to them, and it's all used, not how it's supposed to be used. Like 86% or something.
Yeah.
I mean, and they know this. This is actually illegal. So,
yep.
Yeah,
I know.
Their training materials The NCFA's training materials describe adoption as a good social institution with positive outcomes for birth mothers, birth fathers, birth families, individuals who are adopted, and of course, adopted families. That's in their training materials.
And again,
funded publicly.
And everything is, so many of those are evangelical Christians, you know, this baby takers, I'm going to call them.
It says the religious overtones and adoption messaging are ubiquitous. So it says, even if purposely in secular spaces, they're still doing the messaging.
Right.
Good Christian homes. That's part of the messaging.
Gosh, I know. Oh, well, there's a lot in this chapter. I think really people should read the book.
Yeah. I honestly think it's a must read.
A must read. Yeah. I think we should put, you know, I often say these things and then forget to add things to our show notes, but I think maybe we,
yeah.
Well, we do. We read these books and we tell people to read them and yeah. They're on our list every week. So,
yeah.
Whew, that was not a fun chapter. I mean, not that any of them are fun. It's important. No. They're important chapters, important things to discuss because this is now, you know, we're caught up in current times and this is happening now and people need to know.
Yeah.
So next week, we've got two chapters to read, Camille and Stephanie. I'm sure those will be heartbreaking.
I was going to say, Marnie, expecting that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have a great guest.
We do. Like
our Patreon.
Yeah.
Our good friend.
Yeah. See you soon for Jessica.
See you soon for Jessica. See you in a minute.
See you in a minute. What was I thinking?
Hello. Excited for today's guest because she is part of our monthly Patreon Zoom, which is just, I look forward to it. And we got to meet you in New York. So this is really special. I've been wanting to hear your story. Please welcome Jessica from upstate New York.
Welcome.
Hello. I'm so excited to talk to you all, to you both. Yeah, it's really exciting.
We're excited to hear the full story.
I mean, I really know nothing. So
yeah.
Funny, right? That we have been in each other's orbit for a bit now. And yeah, this will be the first time that we talk about it.
Now, have you told your story elsewhere?
No.
We have a lot of, you know, first timers on the podcast. Like, well, Jane, who we were just talking about, was her first one. And then off she went. It, you know, broke her out of her shell and she's been on you since then.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, Jane. Yeah. And I feel like it's a world premiere for the people who grew up in the same. Remember the world premiere videos on MTV? So it's world premiere.
And so tell us your story from how you'd like to tell it. Origin, beginning, or where would you like to jump in?
So, I was born and raised in upstate New York.
And are you a baby scooper like we are?
I am, a baby scooper. I was 1970, and I was adopted to a family that had already had three sons biologically.
Oh.
My mother wanted a girl, and so she got really sick after my last brother was born, and she couldn't have any more children, and so they put into, I think it might have been Catholic Charities, and, you know, tried to get a girl. And so about 4 years later, or 5 years, I never can remember the math, but got a call that there was a baby girl available. So I was born in March. Then I went into foster care for a while, not too long, I think like 2 months, and then went to my family.
I will say, I believe that that foster care too is just another trauma, right? Because you do.
Oh, yeah.
Probably not bond, but attach. And then you're right. You have to leave again.
Yeah. I actually wrote to the state through like the FOIL, you know, like Freedom of Information. And they sent back a letter saying, no, that just doesn't count. You know,
it's insane. It doesn't count. Everything else does, but not that.
Right. Yeah. Freedom. What does that mean? Freedom.
Yeah.
Right? So very interesting. But yeah, so I grew up in a very interesting area. It was a small city, industrial kind of city. And it's really, a really tough city. We lived in a neighborhood that was not necessarily, I wouldn't say it was safe. I think it was a little bit more safe when my brothers were coming up. And then when I was coming up, it was pretty unsafe. And there was a lot of really tough situations that I witnessed or was a part of. And a lot of times I would think to myself, like, you know, where the heck did I land? You know, this is really
crazy. You know you were adopted? They told you at a young age?
No. So actually, I didn't know I was adopted until I was probably, I think I was about 8 or 9.
Oh, that's late.
It is late. And one of the things that I noticed when I listened to podcasts, you know, your podcast and listen to the stories of other adoptees, and when they talk about finding out, I haven't heard many people say the intense, profound trauma that that caused. I adored and loved my parents so much. I was just out on the street, like playing with my brothers or whatever. I was always just out there with my older brothers, and they were teenagers and getting themselves into mischief. And there was, like, you know, gangs of them that walk around, and my mother always tasked them to watch me. Right. And so I was being teased by a group of them. And I remember my brothers saying, you know, yelling at the kids to stop. And I went and sat on the porch at home, and somehow my folks came out and asked me what was wrong. And I said, they're teasing me about being adopted. And my mother, kind of in a huff, said, well, you are. Mm. I think that that was something that she would have taken to her grave. Obviously, that probably wouldn't have worked out, but it was really, really, really painful. I think that was a pain that I can conjure up at any moment.
Yeah, it's like a betrayal or something, because it's very late. I don't remember being told, but I'm glad I knew, because I was teased also by my brother's friends, but I knew. So I had, you know, I had that in place. Like, not to know would be, wait.
It was awful. It was awful.
I mean, yeah. So what
I could think of was how I just wanted my mother to be my mother. I just wanted my father to be my father. And it was excruciating. And they weren't.
Did she expound on it at all? Or just kind of like, yep, you were. And then no more conversation about it?
Yeah. I'm a very visual person. I'm an artist. And I taught art for a long time. And there's this vision of this chair. She was working on this, like, unfinished chair, this rocking chair. She was painting it. She was like OG, like DIY. She was always doing something. She was amazing at it. And she was just working on this chair. And she continued to work on the chair while I laid in her bed. And I think my dad came in and checked on me, and I was just ripped apart. Like, it was almost like somebody told me they died. Yeah. Right. That's kind of mourning and grief and the pain. So I think the only thing, she wasn't equipped to talk to me about it. Right. She was very abused as a kid. She wasn't ready for that. So they brought me to the store. She had to get more paint. So she brought me to the store, and they bought me this big pencil, you know, so, like, I have these visions of the chair. Right. And the pencil from this terrible, horrible, painful moment. And then really there just wasn't any more talk about it. My father just passed away last May. It'll be a year. My brothers said, what are you going to do with the chair? And so I took it out back and I burned it.
Oh,
and,
that's and it was symbolic.
Right. And it wasn't because I was angry. I wasn't angry at her. I wasn't doing it. I know that sounds like it's such a horrible thing to do, but
no.
I was kind of like letting it go, and letting it go for her, for my mom too. It was kind of like, let's just let this moment she wasn't ready for it. It wasn't right. It was painful. And so my brothers and I we have a horrible sense of humor. So we kind of laughed. We're like, yeah, burn it, burn the chair, you know? So that's what we did, you know? So then I kind of went on with my life, didn't talk about it, but like with my family, I didn't talk about it. With my friends, with people, whoever wanted to listen, I kind of became really, I've heard other people say this, like, yeah, I'm cool, right? Because I'm adopted. Like, I've got this specialness about me. And that was okay. And I was always sneaking around, like, trying to find information or sort of daydreaming about who my mother would be, like we all do, right? When I was walking downtown with my friends, I was just so cool that I was like, I'm going to stop in this office. And I slid into this lawyer's office that was the lawyer that handled my adoption. And the reason I knew that was because it was like right down the street from us. It wasn't far from where we lived. And my neighbor worked for that attorney. So as I'm walking downtown, like, we would go down and have lunch at Woolworth and go to Strawberries Records and Tapes and just hang out, you know, I jumped in there and I was like, I need somebody to help me find my mother.
Were you a teenager at this point?
I was probably about 13. And I just was so impulsive that way. Like, I was just like, I'm gonna just do this thing. And I did. I never told my mother. I'm sure that the attorney told my neighbor, who was the secretary there. She wasn't there the day I went in. You know,
did they help you?
That's what I was just going to ask.
It was a she, and she had adopted children, and she, you know, I got this sort of like scripted answer. Well, I'd be more than happy to help you when you get big and you have your own family, and you, if you still want to.
I was like, whatever. Please.
When you get big.
It was like.
And not until you have your own family.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. And what does that look like? How do you know? Right. So it's just very interesting. So yeah, so I kind of, that was kind of my life, right? Just being sneaky about it, looking in my mother's dresser drawers when she wasn't around. And, you know, there's a box in their closet that had some adoption papers. I read those and I tried to talk to them about it. And sometimes my mother would be pretty relaxed about it, but there wasn't a lot. It just said, like, he liked to fish. He liked cars. He was Italian. My mother, not much about her.
Oh, more about the father.
Interesting.
It is interesting because I think, as I know now, she was just so young. And he was a lot older. And she was reporting it, right? So I just envision this young woman being like, so enamored with him and writing out like who she wanted me to, you know, to know or wanted to report, I should say. Right.
Like, so the father is this, and the father is that. And
not even
taking her self-importance into account. Yeah.
That's how I look at it now, knowing what I know. So life was a mess. I got married to somebody who I was with since middle school. We got, you know, I just really kind of pushed that relationship because I was so attached to him and just really wanted getting married and, you know, wanting that stability and happily ever after. And that lasted a hot second before I, you know, decided I was going to get, you know, go into this other relationship. And I got married to him, and we have my two older boys. And that was such a volatile, I don't know if volatile is the right word, but it was just like this, I guess, like in Al-Anon and AA, they say you should never marry your soulmate, right? Because it's just too intense, right? There's just so much intensity. Like, in that relationship was very intense. He had alcohol problems and it was madly in love, right? But he was never someone I could trust that I knew what he was up to. And we had a lot of fun, and it was just really like this wild relationship. And, you know, he went on to become a prosecutor for the Department of Justice in DC. We lived in DC when the boys were born, worked for Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, which was the worst job he could have gotten. And he wound up, you know, stealing from the evidence rooms.
I was going to say, using
drugs and stealing and the money. And I never knew where he was because he traveled a lot. For his job. He was out of the country or in another city and was getting into a lot of problems that I didn't even know about. And I was home with the two boys in DC. He wound up I saw the writing on the wall and I needed to get home. I needed to get back to where my folks were so that I could have some support, because I couldn't imagine trying to stay in DC with such issues. So like, life just was like such, you know, now that I know what adoptees go through and like what, you know, coming out of the fog, so to speak, there's no mystery why I was in that relationship.
No.
Right. Did all the drama, did the birth of your children, like we hear from many people, spur any interest of your own, you know, like, oh, maybe I should find my roots? Or B, did that drama of what was going on kind of put all that on the back burner?
It did. It put it on the back burner just because I was in survival mode. I mean, we moved back up here to upstate. He wound up a heroin addict, robbing banks and local stores. And he was in prison for a long time, and we lost everything. So I was in survival mode. I mean, I lost.
Yeah.
Like,
I was still in your 20s at this point.
I was in my 30s, actually. Mm-hmm. My early 30s. You know, we lost everything. I had to move in with the boys who were babies. I had to move into my folks' house. My mother wasn't, again, equipped for that. Very hard for her to be, you know, watch this happening to us and having us in the house. And we laughed because my mom had all these little knickknacks that were like fake muffins and fake coffee cups. And the kids were always like trying to eat the muffins. And that it was just, so I found this
chaos.
Little chaos. It was just like, literally, I had no car. I had no money. He put all of our money in his, you know, in an intravenous, you know, needle and was a heroin addict. And so
I'm sorry.
It was awful. Yeah. Right.
Is he okay now? Not that this is his story. Just curious.
I don't really know. I don't think so. I really tried to have the kids after he got out of prison. I tried to keep the kids connected to him as much as we could, but it was very touch and go when he would show up. So it just petered off after a while. And, you know, being adopted and going down these avenues of learning about our family, I've been trying to really just be super conscious of that with them, right? Because my husband has been their father since they were 4 and 6. So I really don't want them to lose the idea that, you know, they should have access to him, whatever that means to them. And I would be there for them with that, just knowing what I know, what I've been dealing with. So anyhow, it wasn't until I kind of stabilized my life again. I finished up my teaching degree, started teaching art. You know, I finished up my master's degree while the boys were little. There was a lot of daycare, a lot of babysitting. You know, it was very tough on us. It was a long stretch. And I've got to work with them on all of the trauma they had, right?
Yeah.
So I do my best. And they're adults now. They're in their 20s. And then my husband and I had a third child, and he's 15 now. So once I really kind of did the work of getting myself back on track so I could afford to raise my family and meet somebody stable and that kind of thing. Once life started to stabilize a little bit, I got back on the journey. So in 2020, I really wanted to do a couple things. You know, I had this mourning for the loss of my potential, and it was very deep. And I really wanted to do a few things. One was I wanted to open my business. And the other thing was to, you know, find my biological mother. And I had a DNA kit laying around forever. And I really just didn't want to spit in it because I'm thinking I'm just going to get a ton of people and I'm not going to get what I want. Right. So that same year in 2020, New York State opened up the adoption or the original birth certificate. So that's what happened is I got my original birth certificate. Oh, it was crazy taking that step to even open up the envelope. My UPS guy is a neighbor. And so he texted, he was supposed to have it signed, you know,
signed.
Right. And he's like, I'll just leave it. He's a friend of ours. Just leave it on your, you know, in your breezeway and I'll text your husband and let you know when it's there. And so it is interesting too. I would love to talk to UPS drivers because he said to me that he had stood in front of a woman when she opened hers. Can you imagine?
No.
Right. And he asked me, he said, what is this document? May I ask what, because there's a lot of documents that I've been delivering lately. And I said, well, it's
in 2020, like when.
Yeah. Yes. It's really profound. It's really.
Think of that. I've never thought of that.
Right.
Everybody at once getting theirs.
Yes. Yes. I think that a lot of people were probably feeling the same way I was when it opened up. It could very quickly change, right? This could be a can of worms that the state was like, oh God, we shouldn't have done this, you know, and then somebody in the legislature could have very easily changed this. So I think a lot of us just jumped on it and did it. So he said he'd been delivering so many, you know, documents to people. And so I told him the story. So I drove around with the envelope for the whole day. My son was little at the time. He was in fifth grade and a little bit impulsive. And I thought, I have so many errands to run with him. I don't want him to snatch it out of my hand and be like, let me, you know, so I just put it in my bag and I drove around doing everything. And I think we were talking about this on the Zoom the other day. I literally was taking pictures of the envelope wherever we went and sending them to my husband, like it was Flat Stanley.
Yeah.
Like, oh, Flat Stanley. Yeah. Like, look at me and grandma having a margarita. You know, like, so yeah. I got home that night and I was by myself. My husband was on a ski trip and the kids were all in bed. And I opened up the envelope and I just pulled it out one line at a time because it was one of those flat cardboard envelopes. Mm. And I just pulled it out one line at a time. And I just would breathe. And I mean, it was so intense. One of the first things I saw was that I had a name. It was Jessica Hope. And oh,
Jessica
that was,
Hope.
And I lost it. Like I couldn't. Mm,
that's lovely too.
It was lovely. I never really imagined having a name that was obviously chosen for a beautiful reason.
Yeah.
Right. Like it was very lovely. And so I lost one of my older sons walked in the room to see what was going on. And he was trying to help me decipher the last name that I had and my mother's last name, because it was something I'd never seen before. I couldn't really figure out even what the nationality was. And just going back about a month or so, I was kind of doing this countdown to 50. And so I was journaling, doing a visual journal. So I was drawing pictures in this visual journal of this journey to 50. And then, you know, this was a part of it. So I was drawing pictures of all of these experiences, you know, like opening up this thing and the name and, you know, just visually putting into my journal the things that would hit me, right? So one of the things that was very hard was looking at the father, you know, you get the mother's thing and it says, what was odd is they said she was like 27, which wound up not being the case.
Because you know that she was very young. You said so. Yeah.
Yeah. And I actually didn't really know until after the birth certificate how young she was. I thought, okay, well, she was 27. That's odd. It doesn't make sense based on some of the other stuff that I saw. And then you get down to the father information and it's blank. And that was a really fun journal entry for me because I drew some very vulgar things in my journal. And they were both, because he wasn't listed. She was from a town that was super close. Mm. And I just, and it's funny because I just, you know, how we do that thing where we fantasize about who we are and where we're from. And I was from this little town that I wouldn't really want to be from. So I was like, oh, this stinks. Like,
I had that too, where I was like, that's not me. Yeah.
I want to be from like, you know, some really cool place.
Yeah. Glamorous. So,
right?
Glamorous. Yes.
I already grew up in a factory town and now to find out I'm from
exactly.
One.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You know, and I have to say like growing up too. And I was from this neighborhood in this city that was, and my parents were not wealthy. That was a very interesting thing as far as like taking a child from a girl that was underprivileged, giving her to a family that was underprivileged, right? Like, and we talk about this privilege. So it was very interesting because growing up, I thought this can't be what she wanted for me, right? This couldn't be. This couldn't possibly be like when, you know, I've got men standing in my window on a bucket at night watching me through the window, you know, or being chased through the cemetery or, you know, being exposed, but, you know, like all this terrible stuff. And I just felt like, why is this my life? Like, why? Like, she couldn't have possibly wanted this for me. And is this what adoption is? Right? Like, they say that you go off and have a better life, right? This narrative. And I'm like, and don't get me wrong, like, I love my brothers. And I really kind of took pride in this like crazy life we were growing up in. It was like an outsiders movie, right? It was like something from a book. I feel like I was a street kid and it was kind of cool, but like, still, and I love my parents, but it was so mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
How could that be better? And so anyhow, so fast forward, I didn't think that I would try to look for her, but you know how that is. Social media, it took me no time to just
put in the name.
And it was very specific, her name, like very specific in the town. Like there couldn't have been another person in that town with that name. And in fact, so I found her quickly. And about a day later, I messaged her, which is very funny. I messaged her on Instagram and she had to be at that point in her 70s. And
she had an Instagram?
Right, right. And she got back to me within about an hour or so. And it was very sterile, very walls up. I started by saying, "Hi, this is Jessica Hope. Thank you for this beautiful name. I hope that your life has been well." You know, the whole thing, like, I'm not here to upset your life, you know.
And we, she, yeah, the disclaimer that we always have to make. Yes.
Right, right. Because we're the ones that have to be sorry.
Yes.
So she conversed with me for about an hour. She would only answer questions. She would not ask me anything about myself. And it was very hard because I kept looking at this conversation as it was going on, is that I cared far more for her than she cared for me. That's how I felt.
Yeah.
I even asked her if she was safe during her pregnancy, because I thought, well, what if she was a, you know, like a victim of some sort of abuse, or was she supported? She said her mother died about a year before I was born. Her mother died. So she didn't have anyone. She had no siblings. She never told her father. She told no one about me except my father, who she refused to tell me.
How did she hide it?
That's what I asked her. She said just the fashion of the time. And then reading, "I would meet you anywhere." Yeah. I thought, okay, maybe she did the same, right, as Yumi, as maybe she didn't try. She tried not to gain that much weight.
My birth mother gained 7 pounds and never had a prenatal. I honestly think she didn't know she was pregnant, but 7 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you were a big
sweater. I've gained more than that in the last year. I mean,
I had a piece of chocolate cake yesterday.
Gained 10 pounds. Yeah.
So yeah,
she wasn't willing to tell you. Did she tell you the circumstances or the relationship or
anything?
So she told me that my father was a much older man. I asked her if she was 27 when she had me, because that's when it was on the birth certificate. She said, "No, I was 19. She said he was 40.
Whoa.
Yeah. So I was very angry, obviously, at this person, especially because I knew her mother had died.
Yeah, it's like, what a, yeah.
Mm-hmm. This vulnerable young
vulnerable woman. Yeah.
So, like I said, she wouldn't ask. So I finally said, "Do you want to know anything about me?" I was just so hurt. And leading up to it and telling my friends that I was going to do this, everybody was just showering me with love before I found out who she was, and saying, "She's going to be so happy. It was you. You know, like, look, Cindy, you. Jessica, you, right?" And it was the opposite, right? It was the opposite. She didn't ask anything. There was no, "How have you been? Were you healthy? Were you happy?" It was very much her saying, you know, just these very short answers. Mm-hmm. So
did you get the feeling that maybe she was, you know, since the law changed in 2020, like that she was kind of expecting this day would arrive?
Yes, absolutely. Because she went right to health information. "Would you like to know anything about health?" Right.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
So she did say he was married. My father was married. And, you know, this conversation went on for about an hour, and it was all through Instagram messaging. And at the end of the message, she said, "I'm going to go now. I'm going to be away for a while. I hope you understand that I'm going to delete all of these messages."
Was she now married? Like,
something.
At that point, she told me she had children that she'd never told her children about.
Okay.
About me.
She's also in her 70s. So you think, okay, if something happens to me, they'll read this.
Yes. She did say also that her husband had died when her children were young. So she had lost me. Well, she lost her mother. She lost me. She did express that she would never have wanted to give me up if circumstances were different. She lost my father. Then she got married, had her own children, had her children. I can't believe how often I say that.
I know.
And then he died and they were young. And so she was forced into this single motherhood.
Yeah.
So she had a lot of loss.
She did.
Right. So that has been our relationship. And actually, I got to say, when she said that she was going to delete it, I literally typed out, "Oh, so now I'm the other woman." And I didn't send
it. Oh, you didn't send it.
Because of course I go right to that like comedic, that comedic, you know.
I know, same. Deflecting, humor deflecting. Because I was just going to say the most shocking thing to me about this story is that you found a woman in her 70s on Instagram.
Right? I mean.
So this went on, this sort of dynamic of her being the one that was, I was more concerned with.
Where did it go on? What did it go on Instagram or did you switch
to texting?
It
went on with Instagram. And I left her alone for about a year or so. And then would revisit.
That took a lot of tenacity to do that, I guess.
Yeah. I think I really needed to process what I had been given.
Did she tell you how old your siblings were?
No, she didn't want to tell me a word about them. She did say they were boys, which was interesting because I grew up with three brothers. I have three sons and she has three boys.
Wow.
You can't get a girl, right? I was like laughing.
Yeah.
Oh, there's no girl. I was the girl. So
did you look in the pictures on Instagram and see them?
I absorbed that like so much before because I figured she was going to shut it all down. So I went on a, you know, social media tirade trying to absorb it all. And I got, you know, a good picture and timeline and ages and stuff like that, just because, you know, you're going to do that, right?
Yeah. As an adult.
Did she shut it down? Did she make it unavailable?
Yeah, she did. And so this went on for a few years. We've been kind of in this mode of me asking questions, her answering. Sometimes on a very rare occasion, she's been open. One time, I think it was about a year ago, I asked her about my birth story. She said to me, on the day you were born, I went into labor and, you know, your father wouldn't come with me. No one else knew. So she said this was her quote, which gutted me. She said, I drove myself to the hospital in labor and I drove myself home in tears.
And
she said that she stayed with me for almost 3 days in the hospital and she was able to spend that time with me, which I just learned that about a year ago, which
I just learned that recently too, that I
really
6 days. Yeah, 6 days. I never knew that.
Wow. Yeah. And that's such an important part. I feel like it's one of the most important pieces of information I think I've gotten. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
But 100%. It just made me feel like there was that love in those first moments, you know.
I just think of her driving herself home.
Yeah.
There is a trauma there that is very deep.
I mean, you can't even drive yourself home after a colonoscopy. So the fact that
they let her.
Yeah.
Right. She said she got very little health care while she was pregnant with me. So, you know, I think it was about 2 summers ago, I kept revisiting, you know, would you tell me who my father was? And I think it was not last summer, but the summer before, I finally asked her. But at the same time, I had already put some DNA into 23andMe.
I was just wondering if he'd gone down that road.
She wasn't going to tell me, so I figured I'm going to, you know. But at the same time, I was almost about to get my results back. I think, forget how the time frame went. She told me who he was.
Oh, she did. She came.
Yeah. And what she said was, I'm ready to tell you because he died 2 months ago.
Oh,
I was just going to say, because the guy was in his 90s at that point, right?
Right. Exactly. She told me who he was and she told me that I needed to use that information or take that information very seriously, sort of like, be careful with that. That's, you know, between you and me kind of thing. She didn't say that, but like, that was the gist of it.
I mean, sorry, it's your choice.
Yeah. Right. The DNA came out. I found a first cousin with the same last name, confirmed it. He reached out to me, the first cousin. The math wasn't very hard to figure out who my father was. So this cousin knew.
Yeah.
You know, it's not very hard once you get into that kind of stuff. Like, you know what your family is structured, you know, right?
Right.
So he said, I can contact, you know, my cousin and let her know that you are out there. She's a loving person. They're good people.
This would be your sister.
My sister, right. So there's five half siblings on my biological father's side. I found her. We met last April. She lives in Syracuse and my son, he was in college in Syracuse. So I met her when I was out visiting him. It was very intense. It was a lot. I went back to the Airbnb and I had fever dreams the entire night. I was just so, and like, it was really tough. She knew that her family wasn't going to take it well. And so that was kind of a process. She told them about me in Easter. She told her siblings about me in Easter. They're kind
was
of all
she,
over
the Was country. She the oldest?
She is the youngest, and she's 9 months older than I am.
Okay.
So that was okay. Like,
so he had a wife who had a baby, then gets your mother.
Did all of your half siblings have the same mother?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I know, they had a really wonderful mother, and she put up with a lot of garbage him. He was very well known in the community, larger than life, Italian. You know, everybody loved him. Everybody knew him. The name meant a lot at that time. The last name meant a lot at the time to, you know, the community. So she wound up telling the kids, her siblings that are all older than her, they took it on all different. And from what she said, they handled it in all different ways, but weren't angry, you know, like with me, right?
Right.
They're more angry at the fact that, you know, dad's gone and there's no way to reconcile this with him. And they're angry at him for doing this to the mom and angry for doing this to me. Like, I guess one of the siblings said, you know, she's our sister. And how could he have done this to her? You know, how could he? Which was very kind. I was glad to hear that. I've not met any of them.
And haven't?
Yeah. No. It's a little odd to me. I feel like there might be a little bit of gatekeeping because I'm in contact with the one sister and she's so happy to have me in her life and just really, really open to this. And she's thinking her own way, has reconciled it and forgiven her father posthumously, right? So I don't know. It's interesting. I get the sense that because she has this relationship with me, they're just like sort of checking off the box that they don't have to do the hard thing.
Right. Right. I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe so you need to reach out to them.
I think so. I did reach out to one that's, I think he's in Colorado because he expressed that he wouldn't mind having, you know, an email exchange. And so my sister told me that. And so I did. And we had one email and my response to him was never replied to. So yeah. I think that they had a lot to deal with him growing up. I think he was a piece of work, obviously.
Yeah.
Is their mother still alive?
She died actually quite a while ago. She was maybe in the 80s or 90s. She died.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think that my sister decided to really kind of push them to let their children know. So it would be my nieces and nephews to let them know because sometimes when she comes to town, we go out to dinner and a lot of them are in the area.
They'd see you. Yeah.
Yeah, small. Right. And when they know she's in the area, they'll say, hey, can we get together? And, you know, it's if I'm out with her, she's like, what am I going to say? I'm not going to tell them the truth if they run into us at a restaurant or if they want to come out and have a drink with me and she's here with me. All right. So at Christmas time, they all agreed that they would tell all the kids. And so it's kind of out of the bag now, right? That on my father's side. So on my mother's side, it's still a complete secret. On 23andMe, there was also an uncle percentage DNA that I couldn't track. And so one night I stayed up all night long to try to figure out who he was. Cause I said to my husband, I said, I guarantee it's on my mother's side. And he was put up for adoption. And lo and behold, my mother, my biological mother, had a brother 2 years older than her that was put up for adoption by her mother.
Oh.
He and I are in reunion and it's wonderful. Because
it is.
So this is your
my uncle.
Your birth mother's brother.
Did she know?
He reached out to her?
So he reached out to her about 10 or 15 years ago. And I think about 10 years ago, they met one time. He asked her, really pushed her to do DNA because he wanted to make sure this was right, you know, so she did. She's not public on her DNA. They met when he reached out to me on DNA on the platform. He didn't understand how we could have been related, but I had already figured it out. So I asked him if I could call him on the telephone. And so I called him and he's like in his late 70s. And it was very hard for him to wrap his brain around what I was saying to him. Said, I was put up for adoption by your biological sister. I had probably had to say this to him like 3 or 4 times because he just couldn't wrap his head around
it.
Because he had met her. He knew that she had children. I was not a part of that tree. So
She met him. She didn't tell him, oh, you're an adoptee and I've given up a child. None of that.
She ghosted him for the last 10 years.
Oh.
He says he has such a soft spot in his heart for her. He's so kind. He's so sweet. And we've developed a relationship. I just met one of his daughters last week. We had dinner and we're having dinner all together as a family next week. He's so happy to have me and I'm so happy to have him. His family says that he lights up whenever I text him and he's so wonderful. And he says he emails her every year on her birthday, which is next week, and she never responds. Yeah. So over the summer, he and I were going to meet for the first time and I convinced her to come, my mother.
So she did. Last summer?
She came.
So it was the first time you met her face to face as well.
It was wild.
Wow.
It was wild.
She just sounds super shut down, right?
Yeah.
Like it was probably so painful for her, all the stuff she went through.
Yeah. Yep. So when he showed up with his wife to meet me, I said, I want you to know that your sister's going to come. And I thought his wife was going to fall over because he came home from that meeting saying she doesn't want to continue any sort of relationship. So, and it was very painful for him because he had grown up an only child and just longed to have some sort of understanding of family. And his wife has this big Italian family and, you know, he just wanted that
connection. Yeah.
And so we met. It was a really nice meeting. It was a lot of fun. It was very interesting how much our sense of humor is all matched. And so he left with his wife and she and I talked for a few minutes and she said, you know, I don't want any pictures and I can't have this. I loved meeting you, but I'm just going to go and be in my bubble, and literally uses the word bubble. So I said, well, why don't we just at least look at each other in the mirror? Because it's a beautiful mirror I have in the shop, because she met us at the shop. So I stood in that mirror with her and I couldn't hold the gaze. It was so hard. I couldn't believe I was standing next to this woman who resembles me. And all I could think of was, in an alternate universe, I would have walked beside this beautiful human being and everyone would have known we were mother and daughter. You can just take one look and know. And I literally just had to walk away from the mirror like within probably 10 seconds. I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So she laughed and, you know, made it clear that she was going to kind of go back, like I said, to her bubble. I took some time off from contacting her after that. It took about a month and a half or so.
Mm-hmm.
And every word that she chooses in her responses to me on the Instagram messaging is always, her words are very well chosen, very specific, very everything. Grammar is always perfect. And I thought when she walked away from that meeting, she really has put herself out to the world that she's really put together.
Yeah.
She was a business owner. She was very well known in her community and she's put together, and this would probably bring
it.
Yeah.
And I don't think it would in a weird, I mean,
well, of course not. It's,
you know, but
you know, it's a different times, but she's, I think, you know, I wonder if there isn't some truth to, I've heard this before, that, you know, that the birth mother kind of always stays at that age
at
in which she relinquished the child. And
yes, right.
So era,
because I always
right?
thought to myself, well, she's keeping the secret for other reasons. But then I'm like, okay, not only for those reasons that she's saying, but it's also for the world's perception of what she, right? What she
That's
thinks.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
So when I messaged her back about 6 weeks later after meeting her, oh, no, I'm sorry. I messaged her right away the next day, and then I took a break. And she said, I was so glad to meet you. It was a way more comfortable and nice than I thought it would be. But then I took the break. And so I messaged her. She said, I had stroke. And that's how she said it.
I had stroke.
And this is the person who chose every word.
Yeah, right.
And so I asked her when she had the stroke, and it was just a couple weeks after the meeting. And I'm sorry, but I could not really get past the amount of pain and trauma and secrets that she's been holding on to, and then having a stroke. Like, it was just awful. So I was checking up on her a lot. she didn't really appreciate me checking up on her and wanted to just act like everything was normal with her. She said her and her friends don't really talk about the stroke, like just want to have a normal life. Mm. So I dialed it back and kind of went back into that mode of just talking to her whenever and just kind of asking her questions when I came up with questions that I wanted to know the answers to. So one of the questions I asked her was, how would you have possibly known him, right? Like, how would you have known this man?
I was wondering that. Did they work together or what happened?
Right. Well, he was a teacher. And I thought for the longest time, maybe they went, you know, maybe she knew him from that, but she didn't go to his school. And she said, well, I was the babysitter.
A babysitter. Vulnerable. Ooh. Lost her mother. Gross.
Yeah. Right. And I have a feeling that maybe my paternal siblings might know that, because I haven't revealed who she is, because I asked them to honor that, because she's not ready to be in that space. And she's, you know, she had a lot of fear, and she expressed the fear that she had as this young woman of this man and his friends not believing her and not being able to you know, keep me. And it was all about him. It was this very young, scared girl kind of up against this thing.
This makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
To her reaction. So,
and her, she probably, you know, clearly has shame, buried shame.
Yeah. And
so how's she doing now? And what, is it just still kind of continuing on these sort of sporadic Instagram messages, no willingness to introduce your siblings or, I mean, at some point you do have the right to reach out to them, you know?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, she did share with me a while back that she was far more Italian than she ever thought she was, and that she herself felt as though she was adopted. And I said, well, you can't be adopted if you and I and Uncle are all genetically connected, but I have a feeling that your father is not your father. I said, because my DNA stuff that I've done, I can't track how her father's side, there's no one who is connected.
So she's probably raised by someone that wasn't her father.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which is another trauma.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I just got my ancestry results this week, this past Monday.
Oh, wow.
I know. I got two first half cousins.
Okay.
And I tracked them, they're sisters, and I tracked them, and I'm pretty sure that I found her father. And so I reached out to them. Well, no, I reached out to the one cousin, and she's like, this is wild to me. She's like, you know, I didn't say too much other than I think we're related through a paternal grandfather. And that's the only way I can figure that I'm related to these girls, is that we had the same grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, but so what you're telling me is that, you know, I might have an aunt or an uncle out there. And I said, yeah, I have a feeling that's the case. So,
and I know who she is.
She's my mother, right? I didn't say that, but she and I are going to speak this week. And so like when you say, right, you have a right to know these things, it's only a matter of time where it all just kind of comes together.
Right. Exactly. Puzzle. I'm in a situation where I have a search angel that found my biological grandfather. He was a physicist up in Rochester.
Yeah.
I found a cousin who she's adopted, right? So be listening. So her mother is my aunt. Her adoptive mother is my aunt. But you know, nobody wants to really deal with me in that.
Right. Well,
no, I have my father is the gatekeeper to my entire massively huge family. He's the oldest of seven sons. They all have 3-4 kids. He has two. I have two half sisters. One 3 months older than me, went to my rival high school. She may listen to this. I mean, I keep reaching out to him. I've been ghosted that I'm in that situation, but your story is making me think, and it's very emotional. You know,
it is very emotional. And I've taken little bites at a time and just kind of gotten stronger. My girlfriend laughed at me the other day when I said, oh yeah, I'm just going to message these cousins.
That's what I do. And then I don't.
I actually do go through with it.
Yeah. 2 years ago, like,
I'm sorry,
I would never have done it. I would have been like, oh my God. Right.
And well, this is all really so new. Like, I kind of was shocked to hear that it wasn't till 2020 that, you know, you went a long time. Yes. So it is really in infancy stages, right? I mean,
right. And I think you hit the nail on the head is that I had so much to deal with.
Oh my gosh. You know, when my biological family found me, my mother had died and it was very traumatic to hear. And it was the same week I was going through massive stuff in my marriage. Your mind can only handle what it can handle in certain levels. And
right. Absolutely.
You're doing a great job. You've been doing a lot.
It's wild. Well, you too, you guys, my gosh. I don't think there's anything that we can't handle. You know,
right.
I lost my dad, my adoptive father. And he was really good about knowing that I was on my journey. Mm-hmm. My mother died in 2017. She would not have been.
No.
He wanted to meet my mother. She wouldn't have met him. But interestingly enough, the only time she ever reached out to me was when she saw on my shop Instagram account that my father had passed because he was sort of a fixture at the shop. And she saw that on Instagram. And so she reached out to apologize for seeing that he had passed. And then she just sent me a flurry of pictures of her growing up. And she'd never contacted me before. I've always contacted her. She's never shared any pictures or anything. Uh-huh. So she sent me this.
That helped. That some did something for her.
Well, this sounds like there's definitely more to come. It doesn't, it's early stages. She's got a process around her own shame. Not that, you know, it's unfortunate that we have to make all the twist ourselves to everybody else's wants and needs. But
She was very surprised on, you know, the times that I've talked to her about or messaged her about, like, well, I'm not okay being a secret because it seems shameful and I've lived that way. I'm not okay with that anymore. And she just has said more than once, I just don't understand why you would feel shame. You know, she feels the shame, so she doesn't know.
She doesn't understand that side of it. Yeah.
Right. And it's hard to explain to somebody, right? I think one of the most effective ways I've been able to kind of explain it to people lately is to compare it to what I think some of my friends who are gay have had to deal with identity their whole lives, not being able to be who they are, not being able to talk to their parents, not being able to live your truth, right? It's not the same, but there are parallels that I feel are pretty profound.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And consequences that we worry about, right, that are so profound.
We're both marginalized people. You know, adoptees are a marginalized group. We're not recognized as one. We should be recognized as
one.
We're
not, no.
But we are one.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's been very interesting, even up until just Friday when I got messages back from those cousins, or that cousin, excuse me. I keep coupling her with her sister because her sister's on there as well. But the fact that, you know, this one grandmother, my maternal grandmother, had this child, gave him up for adoption, got married, had a daughter with another man where she was married to somebody else. And then this woman grew up thinking, like, you know, who am I? And then she had me and gave me up for adoption.
Mm. Yeah,
and no one knew anything about any of it. Right. It wasn't like you did it because you knew that it was like a cycle in your family. It was just this cycle that was happening without anyone knowing. It's wild.
God, intense stuff. Well, I know you will keep us posted since we get to happily see you once a month.
Yeah,
and thanks. Thank you for sharing and such a great conversation. And
listen, thank you too, because honestly, before you, I had one person in my life that I really, you know, turn to for support, and you guys are supporting me through this little box every week. And just being able to meet you in New York and being in that room with all those adoptees was just
great. And still
such an incredible weekend, wasn't it?
It really was. So what you are doing has changed my life for the better. And I just so appreciate you guys, and I'm not going to cry.
I know, you're making me cry.
An interview of tears.
I deep breath.
Love you.
We love you. We love you. Thank you.
And
Jessica,
we will see you soon.
See you soon.
Yeah.
Yeah, see you soon. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
That's a journey.
What a journey. Especially, it's so new still. In the last few months, people who, it's very, very new.
Mm-hmm. And we've had some deep conversations with Jessica, and I had no idea of her journey. And I'm glad I didn't for this interview, and it's still going. Like you said, it is in the early stages.
Yeah, infancy, and there's more to come. She's great. Mm-hmm. I love her. I'm so, I've, you know,
too.
I feel like we're friends because we have
too.
Our Zoom. We got to meet her in New York, hung out with her. So
we love you.
Yes. Well,
what
Louise,
do we say?
We say another great episode.
Another great episode. See you next time.
See you next time. Thanks so much for listening today.
And remember, if you'd like to share your stories or suggest any guests for our show, you can find us on all the socials at the Making of Me podcast.
And again, we have a Patreon page so that we can continue to bring these great adoption stories to you. So if you want to find that and donate or contribute in any way, find us at patreon.com searching adoption: The Making of Me.
Bye.
See you next time.